op Amsterdam FM. Radio Swammerdam.
Let's be honest. When you were a child, a teenager, or even an adult, there must have been moments that you've stared up at the sky and wondered what's out there. I know at least I have. Today on Radio Swammerdam, we will be looking at the sky with a very special guest, the astroparticle physicist Gianfranco Bertoni, who is an associate professor at the University in Amsterdam. And as you can hear, this week will be as an exception in English. My name is Tim Wagemakers, and next to me sits co-host Eveline van Rijswijk. Today we will try to find out what are the building blocks of our universe and thus our existence. Eveline, we are two alphas about to engage in pure beta science. Did you get any chance to catch up on your particles, physics and galaxy theories?
I did catch up, but I kind of missed it. I really liked it in high school, and then I became an historian. So I think the world is larger than history, so we're going to find out today.
Yeah, and to make things even more difficult, we will take it a step further today. We've learned in high school what makes up our universe, namely this thing called matter that can be divided into solids, liquids, and gases. But as we will find out today, that's not all. There are things out there in the universe that can't be seen. And today on Radio Swammerdam, we will talk about these things that we call dark matter.
And luckily, we will be helped by Mr. Bertoni, who is a spokesperson and researcher for the Center of Excellence in Gravitation and Astroparticle Physics, or GRAPPA. He specializes in dark matter and had quite a breakthrough last month when he and his colleagues proved the existence of dark matter in our own galaxy. He wrote the book Behind the Scenes of the Universe, From the Higgs to Dark Matter, has done projects at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, and recently developed the app Dark Matter that explains all scientific research on his subject up to now. Welcome, Mr. Bertoni. Did we miss anything?
You didn't. That was, perfect. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. The word dark matter, which we're going to talk about today, sounds quite, a bit frightening. Would you agree?
Not frightening, I would say mysterious.
Mysterious.
Yeah.
Well, it's a mystery we're going to solve today. We're going to find out what it is, why we should bother finding it out, what the relevance of pure science is, and, what it's like to work in one of the most intriguing places in the world right now, the Large Hadron Collider. But before we do that, let's get a glimpse of the scale of what we are talking about.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power.
Yes.
The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. Bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe. Keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Yeah, welcome back. You're still listening to Radio Zomerdam, where today we talk with astroparticle physicist Gianfranco Bertone about our universe. In the song we've just heard, Monty Python quite adequately set the grandeur of our universe, I think, by describing the galaxies, the stars, and how our universe keeps on expanding. And the song seems to capture all of the universe, but the thing is, it couldn't be farther from the truth. Everything that Monty Python describes in the song, the galaxies, the stars, are only one of the building blocks of our universe, and only a fraction. Today we talk about dark matter, which is one of those building blocks. Mr. Bertone, can you explain something more about the elements that build our existence?
Absolutely. So, let me first give you the big picture, right? So you said correctly that we believe that there's more in the universe than the matter we have discovered so far. In particular, if you put together all the stars, all the gas, and everything in the universe which is made of atoms, you mentioned earlier, you know, there's gas, there's solid, there's liquid, and you know we are familiar with many elements of the periodic table. But if you think about it, everything we see around us, including ourselves, is made of the same basic constituents, the same building blocks, which is atoms. And if you go even, you know, at a smaller scale, they are made of the same particles, which is basically protons and neutrons inside the nuclei, and, you know, fundamentally quarks. They're both made of quarks and electrons surrounding them. So if you take quarks and electrons and, you know, just look at how they combine in the universe, you can basically explain all the physics, the chemistry, and the biology around you, at least in principle.
Everything that we can see,
and also, you know, everything we can extrapolate based on what we can see. So, for instance, it's obvious that we cannot see all the stars in the universe. There will be stars which are too faint for us to observe. But based on what we see, we can sort of, you know, do simple extrapolations and figure out what's out there.
And also the energy that surrounds us,
precisely.
We can extrapolate what it
precisely.
Is.
Precisely. Yeah. So, if you just look at what's out there in terms of atoms, we can estimate how much of these atoms is in the universe. And the total amount of it, this was the big discovery, I would say, in cosmology of the 20th century, was that it only amounts to 5% of all there is out there.
So what you're saying is that everything that we can discover is only 5% of what there really is.
Not really saying everything we can discover, because we hope we can discover also what's in the other 95%, and I guess today we will discuss that. But certainly everything which has been discovered so far can only amount up to 5%, unless we are completely misled by a very wide array of observations in astrophysics and cosmology. And to conclude this, big picture of the universe, what's the remaining 95%? Well, we believe, and we'll argue about that more in the rest of this discussion, is that 25% of that remaining 95% is made of dark matter, which is the main subject today, and then 70% is in the form of dark energy. And these are two mysterious substances, and I think, at least for what concerns the dark matter, we might be close to get an answer about what dark matter is.
And what's the difference between matter and energy?
Well, there's a fundamental energy. The only thing that dark matter and dark energy have in common is the word dark in the name. Mm. And they're not necessarily the best names we can give to these substances. There are more catchy names that we used just to broadly define these mysterious substances. For what concerns dark matter, what we know is that it must be, you know, made probably of new particles with a mass. So particles that would be in a way similar to the fundamental particles we've discovered, but not exactly the same. So with different properties, would not be made of quarks and electrons, you know, this matter. But otherwise, it would interact with the gravitational force, just like ordinary matter does. In the case of dark energy, the situation is even more complicated. What we know is that there is something which is pushing the universe and making it expand ever faster. If the matter that was all there was in the universe, then the universe would expand and then either recollapse on itself or expand, you know, very, very slowly, you know, to slow down basically the expansion.
But there's something that accelerates that process.
So in the 90s, you know, some astronomers have discovered that the universe is not slowing down, it's actually accelerating the expansion. And the Nobel Prize in, I think, 2012 was precisely awarded to the people who discovered the accelerated expansion of the universe. Mm. Now, to describe that phenomenon, people have postulated the existence. Well, they've sort of recalled what Einstein did in the early 20th century, when people were trying to make sense basically of the implications of general relativity for cosmology. What Einstein did was to show basically that you can apply general relativity to the universe as a whole and describe its evolution and its structure. And what he noticed is that basically he could not explain the universe he was observing unless he postulated that there was an additional constant, the famous cosmological constant, in his equations. He was reluctant to introduce it because it was spoiling the elegance of his theory originally.
It was like a fabricated element in the equation that made sure that his model worked.
It was a sort of a patch to the theory, essentially. I mean, it was not contrary to any physical principle, but clearly not as elegant as the theory would have been in absence of it. And the funny fact is that, you know, he postulated that because the universe, because nobody knew that the universe was expanding back then. You know, he had in mind a picture of a static universe. He thought his equations couldn't describe a static universe, so he said, let me introduce this patch to make sense of what we observe. He could have predicted the expansion of the universe. He would have been even more of a genius than he actually is. But then, what people realized was that the universe was expanding, cosmological constant was abandoned. He came back and disappeared several times in the history of cosmology.
This cosmological constant.
This cosmological constant. And when the accelerated expansion of the universe was proposed and measured, then it was the obvious way to explain the observations. You know, it is possible to show that if you add a cosmological constant, and once basically all the matter and ordinary matter and all the dark matter has become so diluted because of the expansion of the universe, so rare and diluted, you will be able to observe the effects of this cosmological constant that will start to push the universe apart. And that's what, you know, what the history of, that's how the evidence for this dark energy came about. There's one thing I wanted to mention about this difference between dark matter and dark energy. I always thought it was a bit misleading to say that the universe is made of 70%, 25%, and 5%, because it looks like, you know, the recipe in of a cake, basically. It seems to say, you know, that's all there is in the universe. And that this reflects something fundamental about the universe. And it does, sort of. But only if you keep in mind that the universe is, that this composition is dynamic. It's not fixed in time. If you go back to the epoch where structures like the galaxy we live in started to form, there was, a completely different distribution of matter and energy in these different components.
We are always searching for a moment in time and looking at the division at that moment.
Precisely.
Yeah. So can it also become 7, 23, and...
It can't. No. No, it cannot be like that. You know, we know how these different components scale with time. You know, for each of these, that's the standard cosmology that we teach in our courses at the university. We teach our students how to calculate how, you know, radiation, so it means photons and neutrinos and relativistic matter, scales with time, you know, how it's diluted due to the expansion of the universe, how matter, you know, like dark matter and ordinary matter, non-relativistic stuff, scales with time. And we know also how the cosmological constant scales with time. So if we have a snapshot today of the relative contribution, we can, you know, basically estimate the relative contribution back at the time when structures started to form. And, you know, we have these fantastic observations of the cosmic microwave background that tell us very precisely, how the universe, how structures started to grow in the early universe. And in particular, we can say that when structures formed, what dominated the matter and energy distribution in the universe was dark matter. So if you want to understand how a galaxy, like the assembly of stars and gas that we observe when we look up at the sky, if you want to figure out how that formed in the universe, then dark matter is responsible for it.
But then dark matter is like the fundamental particle? Can I say particle?
Well,
it bears the fundament of our universe.
I would say that it constitutes the scaffolding of the universe. You know, that basically it keeps together structures, it bounds structures.
Yeah.
Dark matter and dark energy have an opposite effect, actually. One, you know, pulls together stuff. So, for instance, if you took the galaxy we live in, so which is a disk of stars and gas rotating a common center within a big halo of dark matter, this was the big discovery at the end of in cosmology at the end of the 20th century, you know, through the 70s and 80s. If you remove this big halo of dark matter from the galaxy, you know, stars and planets would, you know, fly away like bullets in the sky.
I've read the analogy that it's like two people that are holding their hands and running circles, and then every time they run faster, the gravitational pull needs to be bigger, because otherwise they would...
That's right. You need a stronger force to pull things together.
So how can we see if we go back to... Because the dark energy, I think we're getting way technical there. If you look at dark matter, the thing about it is that it's dark. How can we see dark matter? How can we search for dark matter?
That's you know, the big question in cosmology. And, you know, as you can immediately see, is that, you know, currently we have a perfect description of the universe, almost perfect, actually. But the price for that is to postulate the existence of things we cannot see, which is a very dangerous thing to do in cosmology, in science in general. You know, we know, you know, many cases in which people have believed in the existence or assumed that something was out there. The typical example is the case of the ether that was postulated in the 19th century. This was, you know, basically a substance, you know, ether, like in radio goes on ether. That was supposed to be, you know, the support structure for the propagation of waves in the universe. And, you know, this was so popular that we, you know, we still use that term, basically, when discussing the propagation of electromagnetic waves. But we now know that there's, you know, nothing... Well, it's always tricky to say it does not exist. But, you know, as Einstein correctly put it, we don't need it to explain the propagation of waves. You know, we got rid of that idea. And so this is something that was, you know, commonly accepted at the end of the 19th century, and now it's known to be wrong, essentially. We don't want to be in the same situation now. So, we, you know, we're always very careful when making, you know, statements about, you know, we know everything in the universe. In order to prove that this dark matter is out there and then the dark energy makes sense, we need to go out there and measure these particles. And what I describe in the book and in the app is basically how scientists are trying to discover, to detect these dark matter particles and prove all these assumptions, basically.
And how is that?
There are three main ways. You know, one, which is, you know, maybe the one which is more familiar to our listeners, is that, you know, we could create new particles, produce new particles at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. You know that there is this big accelerator at the border between Switzerland and France. And you know that people there basically are colliding particles, protons, as a matter of fact, to very high energies. And the idea is, you know, to search for dark matter is relatively simple, actually. The idea is the following. When you accelerate these particles to very high energies, you can produce in the collision very massive particles. You know the equation E equal mc squared. If you increase a lot the energy of the collision, you can produce mass particles with a mass, which is on the right side of this equation, which is very high. Okay? So the idea is that by colliding protons at the LHC, you would produce these very massive particles, and then you search among the debris of the collision, basically, you search for these new particles. It's technically very difficult to do, but it's certainly, you know, a very clear way of obtaining evidence for new particles. That's actually how the Higgs boson was discovered.
But to take it one step back, if we're looking for dark matter, then we're looking for something that we can't see, so we search for other signs that show us that it's there. Like, for example,
That's right. So we want to prove the particle nature of dark matter. So, for instance, and we want to measure the dark matter particles.
But is it then like if you have a paperclip on a table and the paperclip starts to move, you know that there's a magnet underneath it?
That's the indirect evidence that we have today.
And then the magnet would be the dark matter.
That's
in the analogy.
So the indirect evidence that we have today is that you know, we see these effects, these collective gravitational effects on things we observe. Let me give you like a historical analogy to what happened in the case of dark matter. In the 19th century, people were applying the laws of Newton gravity, basically, to the motion of planets in the solar system. Okay, and then they were, you know, the degree of sophistication of this calculation was basically so advanced that they could measure precisely the orbit of these planets and compare it with the predicted orbit for these planets, you know, taking into account the Sun and all the other planets in the universe. Okay,
so that's again the two people holding hands.
That's right.
Turning,
you know,
around
a gravitational pool, which is provided by the planets you observe. Now, when they looked in to the motion of outer planets like Uranus, for instance, they realized that Uranus was not moving at all as predicted. Well, I shouldn't say at all. There was a tiny modification, a tiny anomaly in the motion of Uranus. And people like Le Verrier, the observatory in Paris, said, look, this doesn't make sense. So either my calculations are wrong, which is something which is very hard to accept for a scientist, or there must be a new planet of this mass in that position, which is perturbing the motion of this planet. Sure enough, you know, next year, the following year, the planet was discovered. It was Neptune that was perturbing the orbit of Uranus. Now, the analogy is the following. We are observing anomalies in the outer parts of the galaxy that, you know, clearly tell us that we cannot explain the motion of stars and gas in the outer parts of galaxy, of all the galaxies we observe, without postulating the existence of an additional form of matter. Like, we postulate the existence of a new planet to explain that anomaly, we need to postulate new matter to explain this anomaly. If we do that, everything makes sense. If we don't, it doesn't.
So we do,
but there's a catch. The very same Le Verrier who postulated the existence of Neptune tried to explain the anomaly in the orbit of Mercury that was discovered, you know, a few years later. And it is known that the orbit of Mercury, which is the planet which is closer to the Sun, actually exhibits what is called an anomalous precession of the perihelion. I mean, it does have a funny orbit around the Sun, basically, which is not predicted by Newtonian gravity. And then he said, he was strong about idea of postulating the existence of a new planet in the outer solar system. And he said, this makes sense if there is a new planet in the inner part of the solar system between Mercury and the Sun, which is perturbing the orbit of Mercury. But that planet was never found. He even dubbed it Vulcan, you know. If you're a passionate science fiction, you may have heard about Vulcanians and so on. That's where this all started, basically. But that planet was never found. You know, we're pretty sure that it's not there actually after a century, and so this poses also, you know, this kind of strange situation. And you know, the answer had to await Einstein's theory of general relativity. So the answer was not a new form of matter, but it was a new theory of gravity. So that's the other possibility, you know, that we are, you know, being mistaken or misled by all these observations, but that the real answer is in the form of a new theory of gravity. But let me, you know, before you ask the next question, because I see you want to ask the next question, let me just tell you that there are good reasons to believe that we are not in that case of modified gravity.
That we're not in a case of that it's a different theory of gravity.
That's right. The strongest evidence against it is that we observe systems in which we observe, the total mass is, again, by using a tool that comes from the Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the so-called gravitational lensing. You know, we see mass through the effect it has on the propagation of light rays of distant galaxies, of background images. So if you look, for instance, at a cluster of galaxies, you can say where the mass in that cluster is. The other observation you can perform is to ask the question, where is ordinary matter, you know, what we call baryonic matter, so the stuff, atoms, basically, that we observe in the universe, and we can compare whether the baryons, the standard matter we're familiar with, sits on top of the ordinary mass. sits on top of the reconstructed mass, the mass reconstructed from gravitational lensing. And there are some cases in which the two are in two completely different places. And that's quite a strong argument against this theory of modified gravity, because this tells us, you know, quite directly that the baryons, the standard matter, is not the source of the gravitational potential. It's not all the matter which is out there. In fact, it's not even most of it.
Because that would imply that it's enough to have this normal matter and this normal mass, and that then
it would all work. And it just doesn't work.
No. Okay, so I think before we go further with our conversation, it's good to have a small break from all the technical and then also try to find out in the next part of our edition today why we even should bother to talk about this matter. But first, Mars Needs Woman by Novastar.
Your commander, it's your cadet. I'm only a rookie and you're a vet. I got this ship, it's kinda like my car. Your commander, new to the game, school survival, what's my name? Well, this mission behind bars. But don't you know, it's getting kinda strange. Your Mars needs woman, can that be arranged? Oh, you best buckle up before you hit the roof. Mars needs woman too. Climb aboard with the speed of light, see the stars before it gets night. Hang on tight, Earth's gonna move. He's a commander, it's your cadet. I'm only trying, but not quite the end. I got this cause it kinda seems so far. But don't you know, it's getting kinda strange. Mars needs woman, can that be arranged? Oh, you best buckle up before you hit the roof. Mars needs woman, needs woman too. Hey, don't you know, it's getting kinda strange.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Radio Swammerdam with our guest, scientist Gianfranco Bertoni. Today we talk about dark matter. Now, Mr. Bertoni, you've proven recently, among other scientists, that your own that our own galaxy contains dark matter. You've proven that it exists, but you still haven't found it. So what does your research entail? How do you try to find out?
Right, so we briefly mentioned the possibility to search for these dark matter particles in Geneva, the accelerator in Geneva. And we say that you can produce these particles by colliding protons together. It is, you know, incredibly difficult. You can imagine, you know, how, just to give you a visual representation of what happens there, you can imagine the size of the ring of the accelerator is the size of the Amsterdam ring, right? And one of the detectors, as one of my colleagues and over in IKEF likes to say, is as big as, you know, the Royal Palace at Dam Square. Okay, yeah. So imagine the Royal Palace sitting and the, you know, the ring going through it, and you would have a visual representation of what, you know, people are doing there. And with that, you want to do precision physics at the level of fundamental particles. Okay, so you have this huge detector, like a five-story building, basically.
You come down there via the elevator, and you enter a whole new world, which
that's,
is
that's a yeah. That seems like a, you know, a science fiction movie when you go down there. And the even more amazing thing, you know, beside the scale and the precision for the construction and alignment of all this this equipment, is that you collide two fundamental particles, you know, two individual protons, basically, and you study what happens at, you know, what are the products of the collisions, and then you have to sort these particles and find the dark matter. That's incredibly difficult, but there are thousands of people working on that, including ourselves.
What if the particles are more, the particles of dark matter are more sophisticated than our particles?
Well, already in this series we are working, they are more sophisticated. This it is by no means guaranteed that, you know, this will succeed. Actually, this is just one possibility out of many. The idea here is that these particles would be made of, you know, new particles, new extensions, let's call them, of the standard model of particle physics that describes everything we see around us, basically. And in particular, that would have to do with something which is called the weak scale in particle physics. You know how there are four fundamental forces in physics. There's gravity, there's the magnetism, there's the strong nuclear force and the weak force. So if these particles have something to do with the weak force, we can search for them with this method. But it is perfectly possible that, you know, they have nothing to do with that, and they would never show up at any collider ever.
But your breakthrough last month was about creating a model that proves that the dark matter exists in our galaxy.
So our paper of last month had nothing to do actually with the nature of dark matter, but it was more about the distribution of dark matter, how it is distributed in the galaxy we live in. So, you know, whether it is it has to do with the weak scale, or whether it is one of these more exotic particles like axions or sterile neutrinos or other things that have been proposed in the literature, doesn't really matter. This was about, where is the dark matter? Do we have evidence for dark matter, you know, in our cosmic backyard, basically?
But in that sense, it was a confirmation of what we already are guessing
for quite some time, right? If you want, it was a precise measurement that built and increased our confidence on how dark matter is distributed, and it allowed us to put these models that describe how dark matter is distributed in the galaxy on a much more solid observational ground, basically.
And how did you measure that? How do you find out?
Well, it's a combination of two things. So we said earlier on that the way you discover these particles is by looking for anomalies. Mm-hmm. So what we did was, let's take a look. It might seem strange, but, you know, it's much easier to measure the distribution of matter in an external galaxy rather than in our own. And the problem is that we sit in our own galaxy, right? So when you look at this big, you know, stripe of stars and gas that we call the Milky Way in the sky, not from Amsterdam, but, you know, if you go to a very dark location, you can see the Milky Way in the sky. That's basically the disk of stars and gas we live in, as seen from the inside.
Which makes it quite a difficult research subject, because precisely, you're one of the factors.
If you want to for instance, measure how many stars and you know, how fast these stars rotate in the galaxy, then, you know, things are very complicated. What we have shown is that if we take into account all the stars and gas we can model we can observe and extrapolate in our own galaxy. If we calculate how fast they should move, there's a big discrepancy between the prediction and the observation. Okay?
And the bridge is dark matter.
And the bridge is dark matter. So even just by looking at that, we can tell how much dark matter we need in order to reconcile the two.
Why should we bother finding dark matter?
That's an excellent question. So what I would argue is that there are several reasons depending on what one is interested in. The first one is that it really gives a different perspective on the universe. I would say that this is the ultimate principle of mediocrity, in the sense that you know how we've progressively displaced from the center of the Earth to the center of the universe. Now we know that we're just an average planet around an average star, orbiting around an average galaxy, basically. So there's nothing special about us. This would seem to show us that we are not even made of the same stuff that makes all of the universe, that we are sort of marginal and mediocre in the universe. But you can also see this as a principle of excellence, in the sense that we as human beings are made of something very special in the universe. And let me make this point even more clear. I told you how there's ordinary matter and dark matter in the universe. 15% of all the matter in the universe is made of ordinary matter, 85% of dark matter. So already we are made of something, quite special. Of that 15%, most of it is in the form of, very dilute gas like hydrogen and helium. The stuff that makes us is very, very rare. This is, we are made of elements which were not even created at the beginning of the universe. The elements, the carbon, the oxygen that is in our bones and in our blood, they were not produced in the early universe. They are the consequence of a series of events, stellar explosions and the nuclear fusion inside stars. It took the universe 14 billion years to create something like human beings and life. And this gives you, a very interesting perspective, I would say, about what the universe is made of and what is our role in all the cosmic history.
But that's quite a philosophical...
It is. It is a very philosophical answer. But, I would argue that, if you're interested in the practical consequences of dark matter, I would, answer by saying that we're in the realm of... pure research, abstract fundamental research, which, if you think about it, is the main driver of any innovation. It never has immediate applications. If you think about, Maxwell working with, magnets and currents at the end of the 19th century.
Which was pure research.
Which was pure abstract research, curiosity-driven research. You would have never guessed that, 50 years later, you would have had television, and you would have used electromagnetic waves to communicate via radio. You would not use cell phones today, and so on. This may seem a long shot now, but everyone who knows about science policy perfectly knows that there is no technological advance if there is no fundamental research. In a time of crisis, of economic crisis, that's the easiest thing to cut, for instance, because it doesn't have any immediate impact on taxpayers. But that's also the best way of moving on. So if you're in an economic crisis, the best way of getting away from it is to invest in as much as possible in research and development, because these are the drivers. This is a timescale that is not relevant for the next government, but is a timescale which is relevant for your sons, for your children, who will benefit from the discoveries made by scientists today.
Is it difficult now to get funding for this research? Do people say, or politicians or our governments, well, dark matter, well, we have enough of our own matter, we don't need it?
I must say that fortunately, there's quite a clear understanding of what the impact of this research would be. And, you know, one of the reasons that brought me to the Netherlands specifically and to Amsterdam is that the university has decided to strategically invest into this research area. So we are one of the university research priority areas. And, you know, we are building a very strong group here in Amsterdam, this GRAPPA group, Gravitational Astroparticle Physics in Amsterdam. And, you know, it's a very international group. Most of us have gotten funding from, you know, the European Research Council or national grants.
Yeah, I also read that there's a heated debate among you about how to find dark matter and so on. And if everyone has an ID, like build under the ground or telescopes, or
it
costs a lot of money. So it must be also very difficult to find each other in saying, like, okay, we're going to try this. We only have this amount of money, so we only can try this.
Right. I think currently, you know, given the current financial situation worldwide, I think, you know, because of the scientific method and because of the rules of the scientific community, I think we are dealing with that in a reasonable manner. The main idea here and, you know, the main rule in the scientific community is to focus on excellence. Scientific excellence. You know, we can have different opinions, but, you know, we're in front of a community. Each of us proposes his or her own ideas, and then, you know, as a community, we decide what to focus on. And so there are different communities, different groups of people doing different experiments, but, you know, the money that goes into this type of research is like epsilon. You know, it's a very, very tiny amount. You know, given the, you know, thousands and thousands of people who are working on that, and of the, you know, typically tens of countries that participate in each single experiment. So, you know, the investment that goes into that, you know, unless you talk about the Large Hadron Collider, which is a big, expensive experiment, but, you know, all the direct detection experiments, for instance, that are placed underground, there's a strong group here in Amsterdam working on the xenon one-ton experiment. Keep this name in mind because, you know, it might...
We're going to hear from it.
Wow.
It might lead to might lead to some interesting results. There's nothing yet. You know, they're still in construction, but there are big expectations for what this experiment can do in the future. And, you know, one of our colleagues is leading, Patrick de Koski at the University of Amsterdam, is leading, you know, a very strong effort in the construction of this experiment, and we hope to see the results soon.
You've given a few reasons why we should bother finding dark matter, and they are on two different scopes.
Yeah,
one is about the fundamental urge of humans to maybe find out what's out there in the universe. The other is that we've been able, through this pure research, to develop the television, the PET scan, etc. What is for you the driving force that you want to study
for
this?
For scientists, the answer is, you know, it's very different, I would say. You know, for me in particular, this is something that really resonates with something, you know, deeply with something inside of me. You know, this quest of understanding the fundamental nature of the universe. And I have here a quote, which is, you know, the concluding quote of the app that I would like to read to you, if you allow me, which is basically what the astronomer Ptolemy, who lived in the second century AD, you know, said when describing his feelings about scientific research. He said, I know that I am mortal by nature and ephemeral. But when I trace at my pleasure the windings to and fro of the heavenly bodies, I no longer touch earth with my feet. I stand in the presence of Zeus himself and take my fill of ambrosia. And that, I think, conveys, you know, the excitement of doing scientific research. You know, it's almost like being, you know, adventurers going out there and exploring new land.
In the last part of the show, we will be talking about how you're going to do that in the next few years. But let's first listen to I Am Claude with Northern Skies.
Above there are no stars tonight, just northern sky, reflected light upon your face. Some people think stars rule our lives, some people they think otherwise, they can be replaced. Where did you go
on that big black night? Did you take the coast road back through your life? See the sand, the moon, the stars that shine the light and say, well, they'll do all right. Shroud our lives in mysteries, brooding stars and stormy seas, if we have any sense. Storm clouds roll, they're free to break, and we're free to make the same mistakes again and again. Where shall we go on that big black night? Shall we take the coast road back through our lives? See the sand, the moon, the stars that shine the light and say, well, they'll do all right without me. Northern skies, reflected light, fields of snow. Some people think stars rule our lives, some people they think otherwise. What does anybody know? Where shall I go on that big black night? Shall I take the coast road back through my life? See the sand, the moon, stars that shine the light and say, well, they'll do all right for me. Go on that big black night. Shall I take the coast road back through my life? See the sand, the moon, the stars that shine the light and say, well, they'll do all right for me. Constellations sit beneath their congregation.
Welcome back to Radio Swammerdam, where we've just been talking through the music because you said quite some interesting things about that. People sometimes get the feeling that you're making things up, as in you're building a model, you're constructing something, and then it doesn't work, and you throw the model away and try again something new. But still, you think that's important.
But so my a more precise quote of what I said would be you know, you might get the impression, if you don't know the field, you might get the impression that we're trying to, you know, explain things we don't understand by making up things, you know, by postulating the existence of something we cannot measure. And the second part of that quote...
It's good to have you here to correct the quote, yeah.
Would be that that's really the essence of the scientific method. So what we do basically is we have a problem, we construct a theory, an interpretation of what is going on, and then we go back and we propose an experiment to test that idea. And then if this idea is not confirmed by the experiment, then we move on with the next idea and so on. So what we are doing with the dark, in the case, specifically in the case of dark matter, is to trying to make sense of what we measured. You know, there seems to be something, there seems to be observations telling us that there is an additional form of matter out there, and we're coming up with ideas about what that matter could be. And, you know, as I briefly mentioned before, there is this very interesting connections with some of the fundamental problems of particle physics. You know, the fact that these particles might arise from extensions of the standard model from particle physics. In fact, one of the most interesting aspects of this research is that there are new theories of physics that come up naturally with candidates for dark matter. You know, they propose as a bonus theory for candidates for the dark matter. And that's what we need to do. What we need to do as a community and what we are doing currently is to build experiments and propose new ideas to detect these particles, to go out there, build an experiment, as we were saying, on the ground or put a satellite into space. And what we want to do is to confirm the existence of these particles, or we want to rule them out, to rule out the possibility that dark matter, for instance, has something to do with this, with the weak scale in particle physics.
Outside of the box, do you all?
I think it's part of the scientific training of a scientist, actually. So typically, what happens? This typically happens early in during the PhD years, because you know when you conclude your master's studies, basically you're solving problems and in exercises in class, to which you know there's an answer. You know, in the back of the book. Or in the sheets that the professor is hiding from you.
Or you meet your teacher and say...
Yeah. That's right. And so there's a solution to that. And, you know, you're right only when your solution matches that of your teacher. You know, that's what happens during the master years. During the PhD, you learn that, you know, there are often no answers to the questions you're asking. And that, in fact, if you find an answer, you can publish a paper. And that paper becomes the reference for that particular answer.
I want to come back to the... we've mentioned a few times, you're putting things under the ground. And can you elaborate a bit on that? Because it's in search for the dark matter.
That's right.
That you're putting particles underneath the ground?
Not particles, experiments under the ground.
Okay. And you're waiting for dark matter to arrive there?
That's right. So the idea... So we've said earlier on that we have evidence for dark matter... you know, in the inner galaxy, in the inner parts of the galaxy, that includes the location where the solar system is, and, you know, in particular our planet. So if it is true, and we believe it is, you know, I think we have demonstrated in a very strong and clear way, then this means that dark matter is basically flying through us as we speak, right? And, you know, we can measure how many particles with what speed and so on. I mean, we can estimate how many particles with what speed and so on. The idea of this experiment is basically, let's build something like a heat detector in which I need to place underground, because otherwise it would interact with all sort of other things coming from space
that
we know
and
measure. And you know, we don't want to have all this background of events. It's like having a noise. It's like, you know, you're having a conversation, you want to pick up the tiny voice of someone sitting at the table, but the environment is still loud. So if you want to listen to the person, you have to go to somewhere else and you know, try to listen to that particular that particular voice. The silence, the equivalent of silence in a discussion, is to bury this experiment, to put it in a deep mine under a mountain. This xenon-1-ton experiment, for instance, that I just mentioned, is placed under the Gran Sasso mountain in Italy. So there's like almost 3,000 meters of rock, basically, between...
So out there in the world, there are boxes underneath the ground that we're walking upon, and then we're waiting for the dark matter to arrive there.
That's right. And the tricky aspect of it is that dark matter goes through it all the time, but the interactions of dark matter with ordinary matter are incredibly small. So small that we can rule out the possibility that dark matter particles interact more than once a year in a ton of material. Okay, this is what we are talking, you know, the size and scale of these experiments we're talking about. So for the until now we've only set upper limits, in the sense we said the interaction cannot be higher than this value, otherwise we would have seen these particles. What we hope with the next generation of experiments is to be able to measure the interaction of these dark matter particles, and hopefully to observe them also at the Large Hadron Collider and so on, so we can reconstruct and the nature of the dark matter particle and make sense of this, you know, 85% of matter which is out there.
We've almost reached the end of the program, but we saw that you developed the app Dark Matter, and you've wrote a book about dark matter, which is supposed to bring it to a broader audience.
And you're here today.
And you're here today. I mean, explaining science to such alphas as arts and dark matter, is that pleasure or pain? In the sense that, how can you get across what you want to say?
Yeah, it's. I think it's an incredibly interesting exercise, and I think it's enriching for everyone who's involved in the discussion. You know, it's enriching for the people outside. You know, the technical field of research, which we are currently discussing, because you know you learn what people are doing, and you know if you try to read that from technical articles, probably will be bogged down with technicalities that be very hard to understand for someone outside the field. But it's enriching also for us because it puts things in a different perspective. It kind of refocuses our effort, and you know it's even a further encouragement to work on things which are you know relevant, not just as academic curiosities, but they are also relevant for the people out there.
So we will be following you for the next years, and hope that you will be here to find the dark matter. But for now, we've reached our conclusive remarks for this edition. I want to thank co-host Eveline van Rijswijk and Sterre ten Hout de Lange, who was our technician, and of course a special thanks to you, Gianfranco Bertone. But before we leave you, there's a small extra.
Hello.
Radio Zwammerdam viert dit jaar haar eerste jubileum. 5 jaar! Voor de Lustrum-uitzending van 3 mei zijn we op zoek naar een vaste luisteraar. Luister jij altijd naar Radio Zwammerdam? Mail ons dan op radiozwammerdam@gmail.com. Dan nemen wij contact met je op.
So you have been listening to Radio Zwammerdam, live from the Public Library in Amsterdam. Come visit us if you like to. We have some chairs and coffee for those who arrive early.
Via Twitter and Facebook, make sure you type Radio Zwammerdam with an S.
Today's edition will be put online later today on the website of Amsterdam FM, and the whole edition will be streamed on mixcloud.com/Radio Zwammerdam.
And next time we will switch to Dutch again. For now, we wish you a very pleasant Sunday.